This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The ever-evolving case against Brian Koberger. We're going to get into it today. The defense is laser-focused, if you've noticed the headlines in the last week or two, on two pieces of evidence that they hope will create reasonable doubt. Unidentified male DNA at the crime scene and the potential weaknesses in how investigators obtained their forensic evidence. Are they anything or are they big nothing burgers? Pardon the pun to Koberger, as his attorneys argue that the presence of DNA from two identified men raises questions about whether law enforcement prematurely locked in on their client while ignoring other potential suspects. But does that argument really actually hold a lot of weight, or is it just kind of the classic defense strategy to muddy the waters, which we all know Ann Taylor is very good at? To help us break it all down, we're joined by retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, an expert in the area of criminal investigations and forensic analysis. Jennifer, when we're talking about investigators finding unidentified DNA at a crime scene, how big of a deal is it? I suppose it all depends on where it was found and all that, but how do they determine whether it's relevant to the case or just incidental? And in your experience, how often do defense teams unsuccessfully use that kind of evidence to challenge a prosecution's case?
Well, when you look at this particular case, so you have to really focus on all the factors surrounding this DNA. As an example, the DNA that's found on the inside, first of all, identifying, is this blood DNA? Is this touch DNA? Is this hair? Is this semen? What is this? In this case, I believe they said it is blood DNA. So from there, that is could be significant, but you have to consider what kind of a house this was.
Yes.
This was a house where dozens and dozens of individuals were often partying, having a good time, and people were in that home that the renters, the deceased, unfortunately, didn't even know. We've seen the film footage, you know, where the people who rent this house, oh, they're not even here.
Yeah.
And that's just one party example. So you have to really take everything in context in terms of the amount of people in and out of the home. If you had a home with two elderly people, no one ever came in, no one ever came out, and then you had that blood, it could be more significant. But remember, DNA can last for quite a long period of time on any given object in the form of blood. And so from that regard, you can't make any particular leaps. And this, in my opinion, completely waters down the blood DNA that they're citing. One example of unidentified on that banister, by the way.
Yes. When I heard this, I mean, I know there's a lot of headlines out there about it. I know some of our headlines are out there about it that make you go, what's this? And then you read about it, you watch it, and you go, oh, okay, I get it better. But my initial thought was, it's a party house. And it's what these two other examples were found in areas you're probably going to find blood DNA, or at least touch DNA, a handrail, and a glove outside. I cook all the time, so I'm lucky today. I didn't cook this week, so my hands are cut free. But on a week where I'm normally cooking, there's usually at least something where on a handrail, in a glove, I'm sure you'd find my blood DNA there, at least a trace of it. So a hand railing isn't that shocking. It wasn't near the bodies like the touch DNA was on the knife sheath. And when we're talking about the outside, I challenge anyone in a northern state where it's cold out, especially a college town. I've lived in several. And you go out for a walk in winter at night or any time of the day, really, you will find probably within 15 minutes 2 to 3 gloves laying out somewhere that somebody dropped, whether it's in the road, on the sidewalk, in somebody's lawn. And again, if you're wearing gloves and you live your life in any way, shape, or form, you're likely going to find that person's DNA in that blood, I would think.
Well, yeah, all good points, Tony. And let's take it one step beyond that with the glove. That glove was found well after the crime. It was found by a YouTube individual, a creator. Mm-hmm. It was found on the cartilage. It wasn't as if it was up into the crime scene. Mm-hmm. And I completely believe that that had been searched and this was left after. It was really found out there in and around where the trash cans would be. And again, well after. So this doesn't surprise me at all, as you said, with all the people passing by that house, dozens and dozens of people, just to look, that somebody wouldn't have dropped a glove. And no, I don't believe it was missed by the initial crime scene mm-hmm. individuals. I've looked at so many pictures of that area trying to see, you know, any sign of that glove being there around the 13th, and it just wasn't.
Yeah.
So for people to make the leap that because a glove was found there well after the date of the event is just, it's a big leap.
It is a leap. I mean, it makes for a great headline if you're a YouTuber or something and you're trying to find something. But again, does it really mean anything at all, especially if it's very likely left after the fact? And yes, great point. It was a place of gawking for a little while there, and a place that people were also going and lighting candles and paying tribute and trying to make some peace and say goodbye to their friends. So there was a lot of people coming and going from that very specific location. One of the points that Ann Taylor is making in her arguments here is, well, why was these two pieces of blood DNA not in the report? Can you answer that?
Well, first of all, I always say whenever you hear something in court and whenever it's espoused by a lawyer,
yeah,
take a minute and sure. and think about exact context and what their drive is. So we unfortunately are not able to see much of this information she's mm-hmm. referring to. Because so much is under seal. Mm-hmm. So I would say, I don't know if that's accurate or not. I mean, I take a very critical eye when it comes to attorneys saying things like this, mm-hmm. Because they're saying it from the vantage point and, you know, that they want to draw. In addition, what I found shocking is there's not much more DNA that hasn't been identified. Very early on in the case, I mentioned that imagine how much time it is going to take for all the known individuals that would have been in that house, all the fraternity, sorority, mm-hmm. anybody that Dylan and, you know, the surviving roommate and Bethany could tell them about that was in and out of that house. Imagine all the DNA swabs that went on.
Yeah.
Imagine how much DNA has been found in that house, but it's been identified.
It's clear. Yeah.
Yeah. It's clear who it belonged to because they've swabbed all these people that were in and out. And so I'm surprised they didn't come back and say there's 15. So they did probably, I would believe, a remarkable job getting samples to, you know, to compare to, and there still may be more samples, and they may actually at some point be able to identify it. But again, party house, difficult to do.
Yeah.
And I take a lot of issue with how she phrased that.
Yeah.
It's Tony, I'm going to give you another example. Do you remember when a document came out and she said, no DNA found in the car, in the office, or in his apartment. Mm-hmm. But you notice she never mentioned 1122 King Road, which
True.
I always found glaring. So mm-hmm. by omission, did she not mention that because they found his DNA in other parts at that house there? And so, in other words, I don't know the report she's referring to, but I would need to see that report to comment.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to break down the questions that I'm seeing a lot of people asking this week about this, whether I know the answers or not.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.